We are all challenged all the time, every day of our life, right? Should I be doing the right thing or should I be doing what I feel like doing? And maybe it's not the right thing. The chances for them being late are very high because time to abstract people is very different than time to concrete people. They live in two different time worlds. But this was something that happened and it was out of my hands. So you want to have, the minute you do that to the person who's reacting, they have to start thinking. And once you go into your rational head, you will automatically start controlling your emotion.
Hi, I'm Rivka.
And I'm Ida. Welcome to From the Inside Out, now a global community that keeps growing every day, thanks to each and every one of you.
Right here is where you'll discover life-changing insights from some of the world's greatest thinkers, leaders, and our everyday heroes.
We believe that meaningful change comes from taking inspiration and turning it into action.
In fact, that's how this podcast was created, in an Uber, where we were both inspired by each other's life experiences and how much we could learn from each other.
We're so glad you've joined our conversation today. The path to meaningful change starts right here, right now.
From the inside out. Welcome back, everybody. It is so good to be back with all of you. I just actually returned from Israel, and I want you to know how meaningful it was to meet all different types of people from all walks of life that are tuning in and listening to our podcast and learning together with us, growing together with us. And it just means so much to us that you're all here and that all different types of people from all around the world are joined together with us to make this world a better place, to make a difference in our own lives and spread that out towards everyone around us. And in turn, that makes a difference in the world.
Yes, we're thrilled to be back here in the studio after a brief summer break and excited to bring you new and fresh content that will inspire you on your growth journey and hopefully bring more joy and contentment into your day-to-day life. We also want to thank you for being a part of this community and want to share that we've had really incredible growth over the summer, even while we were out of the studio. And we are so grateful to each and every one of you for being a part of this. So thank you and welcome back.
And this episode is sponsored by the Jewish Children's Library. This is actually their second time sponsoring since the first time was so successful for them. So if you have sponsored an episode or if you never have and you would like to, please join us. We would love to partner with you. And you can email us at rivkaandida@gmail.com. Rivka with an H and ida@gmail.com.
The Jewish Children's Library Fund is a fund to help start Jewish children's libraries within communities all over the U.S. And they specifically want to create new children's libraries in a community member's home so that there's a separate location besides for the school or shul where children can go and get another taste of Jewish pride and belonging. They offer matching grants and a database to get your library started. So if you or someone you know is interested in opening up a library,
please text Ruvain Rockford at 954-709-9541 and check out their website, www.jewishchildrenslibraryfund.com. And that will be in the link in our podcast notes.
They also have some cute products on their website, including a customizable acrylic tzedakah box. And when you order one of their products, you are joining the Jewish Children's Library Fund and helping start libraries too. So it sounds like a win-win.
It's really amazing what an impact this sponsorship had the first time they were our sponsor. They sent us a message that somebody had written to them when they listened to our podcast. And Ida, do you want to read it?
Sure.
Here it goes. I just wanted to share with you something amazing that just shows the Hashgacha Pratis of Hashem. I always wanted to open a children's library, but it was always a nice dream that one day I would be Zocha to open. In my head, it was just impossible. Then one day I listened to the Inside Out podcast and they were talking about your special organization. That fueled me with such a clear inner push. Only after I realized how befitting this library is to honor my father, who just passed away in the beginning of the year. His literal life shluchas was chinuch, and he had real mesiras nefesh for it. Yesterday, I was adding some new books to the database you gave us, and I got up to a book called A Diamond a Day, which is the book of Hayom Yom written for kids. I decided to read the Hayom Yom for the 22nd of Teves next Sunday, which is when I am opening the library to the public, Be'ezras Hashem. I was so humbled and grateful to see what the Hayom Yom was, exactly the Hayom Yom that made you start your amazing organization.
Wow. We really believe in the power of Hashgacha Pratis, of divine providence, and we've seen it, Rivka, you know, I could speak for both of us when I say we've seen it openly and in a revealed way, which has been quite remarkable. And we hope that as you listen to each episode, there's something in it that can help guide you on your path toward peace, inner contentment, joy, and clarity and revealed good.
And seeing the gifts that Hashem has to offer us in our lives. On that note, we have an amazing interview today, and we feel that this was such a gift to be able to hear the wisdom of Esther Friedman. She gave us the gift, and we are so excited about sharing that gift with you. And the episode is all about appreciating the gifts that we have in us and in the people around us. She is a shlucha in Kansas City, and she is a wife, a mother, a grandmother, and she is also a very wise person who gives amazing advice, as you'll hear in this episode. She studied Kersey, the temperament theory, and she coaches people and guides people and gives them advice. And she's a temperament certified professional. If you want to reach out for her for coaching, I think she'd be amazing. 913-710-1900. And we'll also put that in our podcast notes. This episode is not short, but both Ida and I feel that everything she has shared here, we can learn from, and it gives us a deeper understanding of ourselves, of others, and in that way, we can create healthier, authentic, growth-oriented relationships.
First of all, thank you. Thank you for asking me to do this. So, you know, I was raised in Chabad. I was raised working in Crown Heights. I went through the system for seminary, went out to Eretz Yisrael, stayed there for a few years, came back with a teaching degree. And when I was 21, went out on shlichus. Went from a very Chabad world to a non-observant world. And what happened was people would come to me for questions. I was very young. I was 21. I was 22. People would come asking me questions and in their life. And I had such inexperience and didn't know anything. And so I started, and I always had a love for Chassidus. So I enjoyed learning. So I would start reading a lot of Torah stuff and also a lot of psychology and science, and just to get an understanding of how to help people. And when this came up, temperament theory, I'm not doing this long. It's about 15 years that I'm doing this. It's not came up late. Dr. David Kiersey developed it, died in the late in the 90s. So it's a fairly new, it's based on a lot of old psychology, but he developed it fairly recently. And so when it came to my attention, I found it very, very fascinating, because in Chassidus, in mysticism, you learn about people being a certain type. Somebody, Avram was Chesed, right? Yitzchak was Gevura. So Avram was Chesed, generosity. Yitzchak is Gevura, discipline. Yaakov is Tiferes, and you learn it. You think you understand it. You don't understand it. And when I started studying this, realized how it fits. And it was just opened a world for me that was just fascinating. And it just works. It just works. Understanding, starting to see this, understanding temperaments. What does it mean when somebody's wired Chesed? What does it mean somebody's wired for? Just an understanding of what temperament is.
Sorry, when you share those, Avram is Chesed, can you share with a translation of those words?
So we are told, for instance, that Avram, the first of our fathers, Avram, is Chesed, is his strongest trait was generosity. He was a giver, he was generous. Okay, that was his strongest trait. Yitzhak is Gevura. Yitzhak's strongest trait was discipline. Gevura is strength and discipline. Well, how does that actually show up? You don't see it so much in them. You don't see anything harsh on Yitzhak. If you go through his whole story, you see nothing harsh on him. And when we think of Gevura, discipline and strength and harsh, we think of it as a harsh person. You don't see any harshness on him. But in Avraham, you see a lot of strength of personality. And sometimes he can come across harsh. So how does that happen? What is Chesed? What's Gevura? And unless we really understand it, we don't really know what we're talking about. Which, I guess when it comes to mysticism and Kabbalah, that's understood. There's a lot of stuff we don't understand, but it is so helpful. It is so helpful in understanding. Everybody is everything. It's everyone has everything because it corresponds to the 10 sphirot. Okay, what does that mean? It's very hard to access what the 10 sphirot mean. Everyone has everything in it. So chesed is one of the sphirot. Gvura is another one, right? Generosity, discipline, it's another one. Everyone has everything. The one that you have the most of, the one that's dominant, that's considered you. So by Avraham, chesed was dominant. By Yitzchak, you know, generosity. By Yitzchak, gvura, discipline, strength of will. Okay, is dominant. But he also has chesed in him. He also has all the other ones. It is our wiring. It's our makeup. It's like saying, just because somebody uses their hands more than their feet, their legs, doesn't mean that they don't have legs. It means they use this more than this, but they have everything in them. And what is fascinating is being able to help people, understanding yourself and helping others with it.
Say we all have one that's predominant, and the goal would be to develop the other parts so that they all have a way of expressing themselves in the right way in the right time.
Exactly. And that's where relationship comes in.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is the difference with others that we begin to see our strength or our weakness. And now you either are, you want to develop your strength more, or you question yourself, or you want to be more like them. The trick is to use it correctly. Because when we start comparing to others, we diminish ourselves. When we look at our yesterday self and say, I want to be a better today, I want to be a better me today, that is a way to go forward. But if I am looking at somebody else's strength that may not be mine at all, if I don't have a talent in music, that's not my weakness. It's not my strength. It's not my weakness.
Okay. It reminds me of one of Ida and I's favorite quotes from Jordan Peterson. Compare yourself only to who you were yesterday, not to what someone else is today.
That's yes, yes, yes. That's what Tanya tells you. Everyone is so different. Nobody looks like someone else.
So do you think only when we're in a relationship with someone else do we see what our dominant characteristic trait is? Like when does someone discover that?
So when we're children, our dominant traits will come out. If you have a good support system towards your dominant traits, okay, then you will develop it, you will learn and you will develop them correctly. I don't really want to say correctly. Well, it would be a better word, okay? But what if you are in a place where you are put down for those things that are you, but you do not know why you are being put down for it? Others don't see your strength. They don't see your gift. And you are told no, or that's not the way. But your language is based on you before you can even think. That's what Tanya tells us. Your makeup, your sphirot, which is the wiring of your soul. How do you access your soul? Who is you? So you look into your makeup, the way you've what you want, what you enjoy, what your taste is, what, right? Why? Why do you enjoy these things? Why do you want what you want? That's before words. You cannot put them into words. It is before chachma. It's your wiring. And this wiring was put into place because that's the way God wants you for your mission in life. What is your mission? We don't really know, right? But we don't know our personal mission. But over a life, we will accomplish it if we see our gift. I'll give you an example of myself. I am a fairly smart person. I love learning. Okay. I hated school. Could not wait to get out of it.
That's good to hear. We all have something in common. We all hated school.
But why? Why should that not be a supportive environment? What happens is that others believe you should be different and you have no idea what they want from you because you're coming from yourself. This is who I am. Okay. I cannot be who you want me to be. I can only be who I am, and I am not mature enough or understanding enough of myself to be able to understand or vocalize that. I don't know what you want from me, or that's not what I want to do. You want me to do that? Why? Okay. What if you're not born obedient? There are children, people born with a tendency towards obedience, and there are people that are not. Here's a great example, and we have it right away from the beginning. Avraham Avinu, was he born obedient? If he would have been obedient, he would have been an idol worshiper. He didn't do what his father told him is right. He woke up one day and he said, this doesn't work, right? And he went against the whole system, to the point he's thrown into the fire, right? Can you imagine if you had a kid, a teenager, whatever, you have a store on Madison Avenue, you sell the latest product, the most beautiful, what everybody wants, most expensive product, designed, and it's really, even the king buys by you. And then your son goes ahead, destroys the whole store. And then your father comes home because, right, the store sold idols. And he says, what happened here? And he tells the story about the lady, an old lady that comes with a basket, right? The whole story that he tells. If he was obedient, he would never have done that. But he's wired to do what works. And he realized that this doesn't work. Idol worship doesn't work. It needs to be destroyed. There is a God. So his purpose in this world was to change, to make dramatic change. And then there are people who are wired to do what's right. What's right means you're obedient. You listen to your parents. You listen to your teachers. You do good in school. Okay. Now, if you tell me, if I'm wired to do what works, and you tell me it's not right, and I'm thinking, what do you mean it's not right? What's right and wrong got to do with it? It's got to do, it doesn't work. Why do you expect me to do it? You see what happens here? And I'm not, so that is the what real relationship comes in. Relationship comes in teaching us how to become a better self. And sometimes it's a lot of pushback against us. And in life, those pushback experiences also makes us better people if we use them right, because we can empathize with other people. We can feel for other people who also go through life challenges. Okay, so I'm a different teacher because I hated school. I have my students in mind. I want them to enjoy the subject matter. I took my difficult experience, and I was very focused when I taught, and I taught high school, that the most important goal here was to get that they understand the material in a way that they can understand it. It wasn't about getting the top grade. It wasn't about trick questions on a test. I never did that. Homework till that you couldn't function because you couldn't spend time with your family. That was so not healthy, okay? So I became a different teacher than I probably would have been if I had loved school.
Are you able to share with us, to give a little bit of a summary of what the temperament theory is and how you relate it to Hasidus?
So basically, there are four temperaments. And this was developed by Dr. David Kiersey. And he bases it, he goes back in history quite far. There are basically four temperaments. And the Myla four temperaments is, because people say to me, there are billions of people. What's grouping everything into a box of four? But the great thing about four is that it is small enough, yet large enough to get a grasp on the concept. If I were to tell you there are 1,000 ways of looking at things, at least knowing me, you would have lost me from the very beginning. If you say, let's start four, and then from four, we expand to more, and then you expand to more, now you can work. I can work with you. If you say there's just one or two, that's not enough. If you say there is even 10, it could get overwhelming. So the idea that it's broken up in four is really actually an amazing thing. And in general, in life in Torah, there's so many things of four.
What things are in fours?
Like four elements.
A mother's.
The four elements, the four worlds. There is a concept of four can be a whole thing. And then it breaks down to more. So even in Torah, there is four. There's 100, there is 70, but there's four. So the temperament is what you are born with. And then you have your environment. You grow up in a family. You grow up in a community. You grow up in a country. And all that informs you. Right? God forbid, people growing up through World War II is different than people growing up in America at the time. And that will also make a difference in your life. How your parents treated you will make a difference, okay? So everything makes the character of the person. To become the full personality, it is just temperament. But the temperament is your wiring. And that's going to make a very big difference in how you act or react to things.
So can you give us a summary in a nutshell of each temperament type, starting with the first one, the artisan?
Chesed is to be giving of yourself. Okay. Giving of yourself, though, can mean needing an audience. Because if you have a need to give, there must be a recipient. But the need to give is yours. It's not about the recipient. Right. You have need for an audience. Okay. The artisan has a need for an audience. So are they going to be social? Yes, they're going to be social people. Okay. They love being around people, and they can do it in. So the artisan is we'll start with the artisan, about 35%.
The artisan relates to the spirit of chesed.
Yes. Okay. When you think of artistic talent, it is usually giving. You have to give your talent out. You can't hold it in. So if you have an artistic talent in music, you're going to compose or play. If you have artistic talent in, it can be in anything. It can be law. They'll make a remarkable lawyer. They'll make an art out of it. They'll make an art out of being a salesman. Okay. But it is the act of giving and also needing an audience. It's a very important element in this equation. Okay. All right. So if you think of children, you have children that need an audience. And when it means needs an audience, it's quiet. They'll make noise. Okay. They don't have, many of them don't have Sitzfleisch. What would you say, Sitzfleisch? They don't have the ability. They're not interested in sitting quietly. So in a classroom situation, it makes it very hard for them if the teachers are not hands-on. If the teacher is just standing there and teaching, they're going to lose them pretty quickly. Even if they're very smart, they're going to lose them. Okay, because it's too boring, right? A lot of these children are diagnosed attention deficit disorder or ADHD. When in fact, according to Dr. David Kiersey, according to temperament, the idea of diagnosing somebody with attention deficit disorder, if it's a disorder, then it has to be attention deficit in everything they do. But if they can focus on something for a half hour or 2 hours, but not on other things, then the problem isn't attention. You see what that means? Yeah. They can focus 2-3 hours on something that they're very interested in. So how is it that that's attention deficit disorder? But we call it that.
So it's that's boredom. It's boredom?
It's boredom.
Yeah.
Or lack of interest or whatever. Then you have interest. Yes. Or they just want to have fun or they want to be moving. They want to be out there moving or they want to do something else. But yes, they do not have an interest. And if you don't have an interest, some kids can sit quietly, but some can't. They have to move. They'll be the most creative doctors. They'll be creative lawyers. No matter what they choose to do, creativity is on the right in the Sfirot, in Chachma. Okay. And it comes together with generosity. And then it comes together with netzach, which perseverance. So that type of personality has a very hard time showing vulnerability. There are people who have a very hard time showing
vulnerability.
Because it's netzach. Your netzach is very strong. You have to persevere. You have to win. And vulnerability is the opposite of netzach. You think. When you learn better, you realize that vulnerability is key in relationship. Because if you cannot be vulnerable in relationship, then how can you have a relationship? Who can have a relationship with somebody that has no vulnerabilities? How do you open up? How do you get to a person's kishkes if there's no vulnerability? Even God shows his vulnerabilities. It's so fascinating. We learned Torah by the flood, but he regrets. God regrets, right? It says he didn't know. But that's relationship. You must show vulnerability. If Hashem wants a relationship, he has to show his vulnerability too. Of course, there is different the vulnerability is within the relationship, not within God. Do you understand? Well, we're going to something much deeper. And my point is here, vulnerability is crucial in a relationship, and they have a hard time with that. Okay. But if you understand, if I understand that's the way I'm made up, that's my makeup, I know where it's coming from. And now I can work on it. I can better it. I can use it smartly. I can be mature about it, right? I can use it well.
Can we hear a little bit about the second type of person, the guardian?
And the guardian is the child that is born by nature disciplined. By nature, this child will be disciplined. They will do what's right. They will listen and do what they're told to do. Now, everyone has the need to live and to survive. So even a child who is told to do what they need to do, but it'll affect their survival, may choose not to do that. Okay. And it may show up in different ways. If the mother's too hard on them or the father's too hard on them, they may push back, right? It depends. Sometimes they will let it happen. And it could be very difficult that way too. So, but by nature, they are children that they're disciplined, they listen, and they are easy children. When they're young, they're easy children.
And then when they get older?
So then it depends. When they get, it could be during later teenage years and into adulthood. Sometimes it's hard adjusting to adulthood because a child that does what's right and gets very positive feedback, it's smooth sailing where they're younger for many children. If there's no trauma and if nothing terribly wrong happened, and now they have to face adulthood, and a lot of things will pop up that they're just not, even if you're good, you can be treated wrong.
Are they at risk? They're probably more at risk from being manipulated and taken advantage of when they're older.
Right. They are at risk. They are more trusting, but and some of them can be taken advantage of, and some of them will push back more, depending on what type they are within that character. But they will be much more sensitive personally, much more offended, insulted, hurt. Okay, but it's more offended and insulted and disappointed than the artisan child who moves with, they'll shrug and walk away, or they'll move with it, unless it's a big thing. Okay. They're also used to adapting. The artisan child is used to adapting to situations because they have to figure out how it's going to work for them. If they don't want to do something, they're going to find how to get out of it in a funny, smiley, or other way. You know, they'll yell and scream. But they have adapted to what their desires are and how to get it out of others. They have lived that way through their life. Okay. Artisans are generally mischievous children. Okay. There is a certain mischievousness. Some of them are very easygoing, but they could still be a little mischievous. So there's going to be a pushback. If you don't have that in you and you're the nice kid or the obedient kid, right. You know, and then either you're taken advantage of, and then you resent it. And then you also have to learn how to adapt to other people. So it's a little bit, they can be great students, but not good teachers because they had no trouble in school. And then they get up to teach and they have a classroom of different kids and they don't know how to deal with it as much. Okay. Now, sometimes they can be great teachers. Sometimes they can be, and I'm not saying this all across the board. It's just different. They are very hardworking.
Which one? The guardian.
They're wonderful. Guardians are very hardworking. The cornerstone of society. We would not be able to get things done. My kids in my house, the ones, if I can't find something, 100% chance that the one who found it will be the guardian. I always knew which are the ones that's on time, the ones that's organized. Yeah, the 100% chance. I learned just to go to them. Okay, you know, if I need something found, they'll find it. They have that persistence and that discipline.
The guardian is Gvura in the Sefirot.
Yes. See, people think of Gvura as harsh. They're not necessarily harsh. the harshness will come. We have both a nefesh abamis and a nefesh elokis. We have an animal soul and we have a godly soul. The sfirot of the godly soul are refined godly sfirot who only want what God wants. They want for the benefit of the person, the benefit of God, the benefit of the other. The animal soul, which we use to survive, which we need for survival to exist, thinks about itself. So it very simple. What is the Yetzer Hara? The Yetzer Hara is the pull of the animal soul. The pull of the animal soul is me, self-gratification, self-preservation. It's always me. Even if I do a mitzvah for reward, it's me. And, you know, I'm giving you a gift because I want something back for you, from you. So it's a nice gesture. It's better than doing something bad, but it's still not truly for you. The godly soul is about God. It's about the godly element of us, about doing for someone else, right? It's about saying, no, I need to think of someone else now. So the animal soul also has sfirot. We don't call them by the same name, but it's the same concept. Okay, so the kampul is one way or the other. So in Gevura, it can be very harsh, and you can use it for negative, but you can use generosity for negative. Chesed can be very cruel if it's used wrong, and Gevura can be very cruel. And not only that. Again, the word, they're not called sfirot, so it's a little different, but in the names. But the concept of generosity, of chesed, it's sometimes even crueler than the harshness of gevura.
Well, because chesed fights.
Yes, a true narcissist, okay? A true narcissist who is smiley and so nice and so giving, but actually totally manipulating. And now you can't figure out what's going on. They're so wonderful. They're so nice. They're so giving. But something's wrong because you're being totally manipulated. The chances with Gevura is that if they're harsh, they'll be harsh. You'll know at least what you're dealing with. You see, it doesn't change one day and then they're sorry. They're so nice and wonderful. And the next day they're cruel. And then they're nice and wonderful. You see, there's a different style of narcissistic behavior. Narcissistic behavior, everybody can have because we all think of ourselves. But it's different in chesed than it is in gevura. It's much more calculated and manipulated. But I don't want to go into the negativity.
But yeah, even something like maybe more subtle, like people pleasing, you know, and somebody's just doing something for someone else, like saying yes so that person will like them or they can get in their good meaning. They're doing it or for social climbing or things like that. They're not doing it because it's not genuinely coming from their nefesh like kiss. Would you say that's also misplaced chesed? Or like similar to the narcissist?
It could be. That can be in any type. Mm-hmm. That could be in any type because we have a need for social advancement. Many people, we have a need to be viewed well by others. And to be viewed well by others could be honor, could be monetary, could be, everyone has that need in every single type. So, and then in terms of accommodating, every type has an accommodating type. So if you're going to be an accommodator, that's an artisan, you're not going to like conflict. You may walk away from it. If you're going to be a guardian that doesn't like conflict, you just won't voice your opinion. Each one and each type you'll have. So to define that as chesed is hard. You could, because each type will have similarity because we're all human. But when we talked about harshness, we look at gevura and we say harshness, but the reality is that people who are refined gevura are actually very kind people. They're humble, and in their humility can be very kind. Okay, and then you can have different. They're different. Whereas chesed has a much greater need for an audience, and that can actually impose on others. But on the other hand, they're very generous people. So each one has its wonderful and each one has its challenge. Okay.
Right. The truth is we want to get through all four of them, but I just want to focus for a second on the chesed and the gvura. Is the goal to have both of them equally?
I don't think that is possible. We are wired with everything. Everyone has 10 spherot. The one that is dominant is considered what you say that is you. So for instance, when we say Avram is chesed, that is dominant in him. Did he have Gvor? Did he have Teferet? Did he have Netzach? Did he have all the others? Absolutely. But because he was the line of chesed, so chesed and Netzach, which is the one under chesed, will be more dominant. Whereas in Yitzchak, you would have Gvura and Hod. Hod is humility. Yitzchak was very humble. You don't even hear about him that much. There's a lot of humility in him. Whereas Avraham, it's not a lack of humility, God forbid. It's just he was out there. I'm not Yaakov, Avraham. Avraham was out there. And each one had to do that for their mission in life.
Right.
Okay.
But then Yaakov is a combination of the two.
So Yaakov now is a combination, but if you can think of Sfirot, it's center. That's what Tiferes is, a center. Now, in the both of the sides, you know, Chesed and Artisan, I'm going to do the English, Artisan and Guardian are 75% of the population, and they're concrete thinkers. So they think about what is, what you can touch, what you can hear, what you can see, about what's in front of them. When you come to now the center are more abstract. Okay, that's the idealist is about 15% of the population.
That's the third. The third one is idealist.
Third one, idealist. Yes, and their focus is relationship. And even in Kabbalah and Chassidus, when you talk about Tiferes, Tiferes is the relationship between generosity, chesed, and discipline. It's always trying to figure out when do you have to stand up and be firm? When do you have generosity, right? It's always, and it creates empathy. Empathy is, yeah, this was not the right thing to do, but you know what? You're human. You're sorry. It's enough that you're sorry. I don't have to make it harder on you. It's that empathy. Gvura is, you know, it's judgment. You're right, you're right, you're wrong, you're wrong. All right? So I'll give you an example of chesed. That a very wealthy man here in town, he's gone already quite a few years, and people used to tell the story about him. He was driving downtown in Kansas City, and he saw this a person. It was very cold outside, and he saw this person sitting on one of those rails, you know, on there where the steam comes up from, and he was warming himself by the steam. And so he stopped his driver, he had a chauffeur. He stopped the driver, he got out, took his mink coat, and gave it to the man to warm himself, and gave it to him and drove away. A remarkable act of generosity. Remarkable. Right. And I don't want to make any judgment because it's a remarkable act of generosity. So there's no judgment on this, but take it apart. What are the chances of that coat staying with him? What are the chances he'll be killed for that coat? Right. So getting him a cheap, cheap jacket, three of them to wear one on top of the other, you understand, would have maybe done a lot more for him had he gone into discipline. Is this smart? Is this good? What benefit? What does the man need? Not what do I need to give?
Interesting.
Yes. And that's where relationship matters, because many times, oh, he's so generous. Joe's so generous, but that's not what I wanted. See how confusing that is? They're showering you with gifts, but that's not what I want. But it takes you a while to realize that that's not really what you want. Sometimes it is what you want, and you're very appreciative. So it depends. It depends on the situation. But these are different things that can come up. You can have even in the Guardian giving a gift that they think you ought to have.
I love that example. I mean, I would imagine that happens quite a bit in relationships as well, where look how much I'm doing for you. And then the person feels like, well, not the way that I want it to be done. So how do you how do you navigate that? How do you have that conversation with someone who's different?
So that's, you know, in terms of temperament theory, when I work with couples, that comes out all the time. You know, I do so much, and they don't appreciate it. And the other one is, of course I appreciate it, but look what I do. I do this, 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 and this. But even so, who are we doing this for? So you are doing the dishes. So you are doing the laundry, but you're doing it for the family. You're doing it for everybody. You're not doing it for me personally. Now, women sometimes are faced with that more, not always. I shouldn't say that. It works both ways, actually. But because many times the husband will come home and say, you know, I bring the income, I do everything. Shouldn't there be a meal on the table? And maybe he's right. He's exhausted, tired. Where is that act of service that I need? Or not where, but I need that act of service. And I need it in this relationship. And when you have supper on the table, when I get home, I know you're thinking of me. Okay. And she can say, doing this for the family. You're not just doing this for me, right? But here he's saying, if he says to her, this is what you need, not enough that I bring home the money, that's a problem, right? If he says, I bring home the money, but I do need that meal, that he's making it very clear what the act of service he needs to be done. The problem, I feel I'm doing it for you and you don't appreciate it because you come back and say, that's not for me. It's for the family. So when we do that, you really have to keep in account what the other one needs. And here, temperament will tell you what each one needs. So that's really fascinating. We have the five love languages. Some need touch. It'll be the number one thing of the five. Everyone needs all five. But for some, touches at the top, and for some, touches at the bottom. For some, acts of service will be number one, and for some, that will be number three. Okay. For others, it'll be word of affirmation, right? Everything, and that's where temperament comes in and really shows you different people have different needs and different understanding of things. We all start from the point of what Kirsty calls the BLM syndrome, be like me. So I imagine what you need is really what I need. How often does somebody say, nah, that's not what you mean? I once had this conversation with somebody. I was asking somebody to do something for me. And they said, no, that's not really what you need. And I said, that is what I need. And they said, no, that's not really what you want. I said, no, that is really what I want. And again, and you know what happened in the end? I hung up. I said goodbye. Thank you. No, there was nothing I can do here.
Can I ask you something? How did you learn? Because you said in the beginning of the conversation that you really learned how to put yourself in somebody else's shoes. How did you learn to do that? What was the key for you?
So let's go on now. We'll do one more and we'll go back. So you have, well, we didn't finish on the idealist. The idealists are very, very sensitive. It's the element of Tiferes. The element of Tiferes thinks about the person because empathy has to be, empathy, sympathy is always about the other person, right?
Right.
They can feel other people's emotions. They can even know other people's thoughts. So when, you know, people start talking like that, you think they're crazy, but they're not. Some of them can be. But they're not. It's just so far-fetched from people that are concrete that they not only can't even grasp it, they don't even think it's true. Okay. So it puts them in an odd position because people don't believe them or don't, they're different. They're very different. All right. Very sensitive. As children, very, very sensitive. And as adults, very sensitive. They will usually put somebody before themselves and then they could get very hurt. So it's a confusing situation sometimes for them. They are very, they're loving children and need that from those around them. Again, they're sensitive. Both the guardian and the idealist are both sensitive in different ways. They are the idealist children are heart. There's drama in heart. So you can have, they can be quite dramatic when something happens. Again, though, it has to be identified right. You know, it's one thing when you know what you're looking at. It's another thing when you don't.
And the idealist as an adult?
Also very fine. They're very fine, very in need of relationship. Sometimes they go too deep in relationship. You know, for their own health, you need to be a little careful. But very Adela, generally Adela people. And then you have the rational. The rational is also an abstract thinker. The idealist is an abstract thinker. The rational is an abstract thinker. Idealists are 15% of the population. Rational is 10% of the population. Now we're rounding that off because it's really less. Idealists are a little bit more. Rationals are a little bit less, but we're rounding that off. And rationals are abstract also, but ideational. So, I mean, how many people would think of the theory of relativity? I mean, you have to be very abstract to go with it, right? And yet, he'd have to, Einstein, right? And he had to call his wife to find out where he needs to go. So the concrete is so far from him, but the abstract is so close to him. That's the world he lives in. So abstract people live in their head a lot, whether it be in the emotional element, or in the rational element, they live in their head and they miss. Especially rationals will miss cues. They'll miss things and they will be considered absent-minded. I was giving a class. I had this class of women and they were all very accomplished, you know, doctors and CEOs and very accomplished women. And there was this one woman in the class, a wonderful psychologist. And invariably, she would walk out of the class, come back 5 minutes, 3 minutes later, and couldn't find her keys. One time, two times. And it's very embarrassing, okay, right? You do it once, you feel like an idiot, and you're a doctor, and you're a very accomplished doctor. So one time she walked back into class and she's really so uncomfortable. So I decided I was going to do this, and I was hoping it would come out right. And they knew that I am trained in temperament theory. So I said to her, you know, most people live in the concrete world, but you live in the abstract world. You live in the world of relationship. In the world, she was a very good doctor. In the world of relationship, you get it. You understand. Many people can't do that. Many concrete people can't do that. But it looks like you're flaky. In your world, you're not flaky. You get so focused on what you're thinking about and how to help people and how to deal with people that the keys aren't so important. And you forget where you put them. And I can tell you that concrete people are very flaky in the abstract world. But because 75% of them are concrete, you think this is normal, right? So here's the deal. You're going to be forgetful. There's nothing you can do about that. But you don't have to be forgetful for everything. So if you took your keys and you designated a certain pocket in your purse, and you will not put them anywhere else. You train your brain, hold on to that key from the minute you get out of the car, and you're going to put it into that absolutely that designated pocket. You will not lose your keys again. Okay.
So the goal is not to change; it's really to accommodate.
Right. Right. You have to accept the fact that because I am in my head, if that's where you are, if you're going to be, that's the way you're wired, you're not going to be so in tune to the concrete world. The chances for them being late are very high because time to abstract people is very different than time to concrete people. They live in two different time worlds. Okay. So the concrete person is used to this. The abstract person has to be trained, has to train themselves. Okay. Sometimes I will know before I even do an assessment the chances of somebody is because how late they show.
we used to have guests who always came like 2 hours late for Shabbos meals, and we decided to just start inviting them separately, because it wasn't changing. I mean, like, I guess what you're saying, it makes perfect sense, because it's hard to assume that they can change, but you can maybe hopefully try to work to accommodate it.
Right. And what you see is what is. That's another thing people are not ready to accept many times. You look at your child and the way they're behaving, this is them. Now we have to figure out, is this good for them? Do you have to do it? Does it need a change? I mean, it's always good for them, but are they using it well? If this is who they are, then this is the way they're meant to be. Are they using it well? And that's how you guide them. Don't try to change them. You cannot. We do that. I mean, we're all guilty of that. We start in parenting with absolutely no experience. I don't think the janitor of anywhere, you know, or the sanitation guy starts out with no experience. And yet the most important job of parenting, we start out with absolutely no experience.
Yeah, it's something to think about. Like, I mean, yeah. I do think about it because I started off at 18.
And who set it up that way? Who set it up that way?
Right, but I do think now.
Wait, you didn't answer me. Who set it up?
God set it up that way.
So it's meant to be that way. We need to, we learn on the job. And what are the chances you'll make mistakes?
And very high.
100% you'll make mistakes if you learn on the job.
I'm kind of stuck at what, when do I work on changing versus accommodating? So for example, like I would imagine my temperament is more chesed. I think it is. And right, I want to be able to address difficult situations, whether it's business related disputes or issues that require a certain level of assertiveness and confrontation. But that's not my nature. It's not my temperament.
You learn to do it. You have the ability, but you need to learn to do it. So you work with somebody who can teach you the right words, the right way. Had a woman that I worked with her for a long time. She came from a very dysfunctional home. And that only makes it worse because you're so unsure of yourself. And you don't even, and then you have to pass it on to your children. And you don't, she was just having to work through her own issues with her own parents and the dysfunction. And now being a parent herself, and it usually shows up, you know, not the first years. It shows up when the kids are starting to grow up. And she would take notes exactly how to say. And I'm saying it's your language. It's not my words. No, she needed it. And she would practice and practice and practice. And then after a while, she absolutely got the hang of it. And the change in her was so remarkable. The problem was she was intimidated. She didn't trust herself. Okay. So it wasn't only that she was an accommodator. She didn't trust herself. And she also felt, because she came from such a dysfunctional home, that in order to keep by keeping the peace, it will make the dysfunction better. It'll at least not make it more dysfunctional. So it became a pattern of behavior growing up. And she felt that worked. She was the good kid, the one that the parent didn't have to blame and work with, and the one the parent relied on, right? But now she gets into a relationship and you can't function like that. You can't function like that with your husband and your children, because where's the end? At least with parents, you grow up and you leave the house, right? But you can't get out of a dysfunctional family and then a dysfunctional and make your home life dysfunctional as a parent, as a wife, and then parenting it. There's no end over there. So it has to stop at some point. And you can't keep blaming your parents, because guess what? They were also your age when this started. How do you blame your parents when you're already older than them? If you're blaming your mother when she was 25, well, guess what? You're 40 now. How are you blaming your mother now? If you wanted her to take accountability, why aren't you taking accountability? You can't continue blaming your parents into adulthood. You have to work it through. That's very important, but you have to get rid of the blame. They're human. They're human. They've had their own lives to deal with. So now, if it comes that hard, the thing that I find very effective is practice. You go actually through situation from situation, practice, and it was astonishing. Not only see the change in her, what was astonishing for her was to see the respect now that she acquired from people. People didn't hear her. Before, they didn't hear her. And suddenly, they had to listen. They had to listen because she was very nice person. She didn't become very aggressive, but she wasn't a schmata anymore.
Right. So sometimes I wonder, like in our relationship here in the podcast, like me and Rivka, so she'll ask the tougher questions and she'll deal with some of the more difficult issues that come up, knowing that I do like that side of her and I would want to develop that side of the part of myself that's like that. How much of that should I focus on?
By the same token, do you admire your accommodating self?
I do. I see the value in it. And that's the thing. I definitely see the value in it. And I think
that's the trick. That's the trick that you admire in each other.
Because I admire in her the things that I don't have, but I also think that we have similarities that we relate to.
That's true too. So many times people will say, I am too this, and I wish I wasn't that. And no. If this is what you are, then this is the gift God gave you. And this is what you need to fulfill your mission. Can you temper it? Can you lessen it? Can you strengthen it? Sure, you need to use it for good. And that's how you learn to use it for good. So you even think of a talent, an artist. Okay. They sit there hours and days and days and days, and they make mistakes. They do this, they do that. They have to learn to perfect it. You write a book, it's the same thing. Your music, it's the same thing. How much more so ourselves? You have to work within and perfect it. And we make our mistakes and then you wipe it off and you start, you know. But the fact that one is more accommodating and one is more direct and more assertive, each thing has its benefit. Working together is where you get maximum because you can't be both equally assertive and equally accommodating. It's just too much. I mean, you can't.
Think that. Because you said like appreciating the gift, I think that part of why we work well together, because I think we both appreciate the gifts in each other. In like, I appreciate the gifts you have, and I feel that you appreciate the gifts that I have, and that's why we're able to work together well together. Maybe in other relationships, it's hard because we don't appreciate the gift in the other person that we don't have.
Could be. Yes. Excellent. That's very good.
What if there's the way I am, not me, but the way a person is, and then there's often like the way the person wants to be and where they want to change something. And assuming that we're born with our temperament and then over time with, you know, our social conditioning and all the stuff around us, we're nurtured into becoming a certain way. So if there's the way I am and the way I want to be, how do I know which one is really me? Meaning that there's not like something or trauma.
It's both. Sure. Because we are wired to grow. We are wired to be better. We are wired to invest in life, in ourselves. That's the difference of eating from the tree and not eating from the tree. Like, why did Hashem make this world? Where, think about it, when you're learning Tanya, and it talks about a Benoni. Okay, and it talks about a rush of, you know, rush of a tayvile, rush of a rala. That, in according to Tanya, most of us, almost everybody, okay, is what it would call a rush of a tayvile. A rush of a tayvile is a person who struggles to do the right thing. They do the right thing a lot, maybe even maximum, but there is still that little voice that pushes them maybe to do something wrong. Right? And there are degrees. We are all challenged all the time, every day of our life, right? Should I be doing the right thing or should I be doing what I feel like doing? And maybe it's not the right thing. And you think, why did Hashem create such a world? Why didn't he make it easier for us to do the right thing, to be met? But the beauty, the remarkable thing about this is that is the world Hashem wants. He wants us to invest in our lives. And by us investing and making the choices and growing, we are actually creating the big picture of the world that Hashem wants. Because he could have had it perfect, right? What did he need this pain? But no, he wants people who actually do change, do grow, do refine themselves. That's really perfection in this world. Because true perfection is only God, nobody else. It's impossible. He created a world for us to make mistakes. How can you be perfect? Because he created a world for us to learn from experience, for us to learn to be better. So can you change? Yes. Can you become nicer? Can you not recognize yourself now from then 10 years ago? Yes. But your wiring doesn't change. You still can have more chesed or more gvura. However you change will be within the parameters of your wiring.
Woman that you just described that worked on herself and everyone started to listen to her once she worked on herself. She changed maybe because she worked so hard on that thing ends up becoming more dominant. Does that happen? Or do you know what I'm saying? She's worked so hard at it that it's become...
No, that what her strength, what became was her weakness. Now she learned to make it her strength. In this particular case, she used her strength as a weakness. Now, there is a reason for it, and it makes sense. She grew up in a dysfunctional home. She didn't, the cues and the lessons and everything she got was, some of it was crazy. How does a three-year-old know what's right and wrong, even if they're wired to do the right thing? Only what their parents tell them. But if the home is dysfunctional, then it's, what are the messages that she's been getting? Okay. And now she's 30 and she can't decipher all these messages because some of them make no sense. But this is what she was told, or this is what worked for her. You think about, God forbid, a child in the camps, a way to protect themselves may be very different, will for sure be very different than in society. But they may not know how to adapt. It's too ingrained. The trauma is too much. So now they have to, so they took it to protect themselves. So now you have to learn how to use it to protect yourself differently. It's the same person. You don't become a different you. You're the same person. When people see you in the street, you have the same looks. You're the same person. That's what it means by wiring. It's as if you're asking me, if a person can change, will I now not be Rivka? I will be Sarah. Does Rachel become Leah? What?
My name is actually Sarah Rivka.
Oh, I didn't know. I'm thinking the mothers, you know. Okay, good. So can the Sarah become, you know, does Sarah become Rivka? Does Rivka become Leah? That doesn't happen. You become better. You become mature. You grow. You become the person you want to be.
So you're saying the dominant feature, one of these four things, is always there, but you become better at that and you also explore the other parts of you.
Right, right, right.
Like people are often, they treat their loved ones differently than their friends, let's say. You know, like we're harder on the people that we love.
Isn't that amazing?
So what does that mean from a temperament view?
I think there are some temperaments that will do that more than others. And I mean, it's more prone. Certain time more prone to that because they don't see the damage of it. They don't see the fallout. With a friend, the friend will walk away. But a spouse doesn't, a child doesn't, a parent does, right? So the chance of losing is much greater with a friend. These people truly, truly understand abuse it, lose it. Okay, but they don't think, A, that they may be abusing their close ones, and they also don't think, even if they are, that they're going to lose them. But if they know they're going to lose somebody, they'll be much more careful. Okay.
Is that what it is? That because they're scared of losing the person, or because they're just...
It's not about scared of losing somebody. It's that instinctive understanding of how I need to relate to this one or to this one based on what I want the outcome to be. So if I am wanting a certain outcome with a friend that will just shrug and say, you know, I don't need this, I may be much more careful than with a child or a spouse that won't do that to me. And at that point, I want to get what I want to get. Okay. So, and I don't think it goes into so much thought, because if it's your wiring, you move into that very easily. This is your language. How much time do you spend thinking about every word you say in the language that you're familiar with? in the language that you're not familiar with, you start thinking about every word you're going to say, right? So if it is within your wiring to do that, to be harder on your own than on others, and it's not the right words, to be harder on our own than on others. The right way to look at it is they believe that you belong to them. So if you belong to me, then I can do with you what I want because you belong to me. Okay. But the friend and the neighbor doesn't necessarily, you see, sometimes they can do to them too, but they'll be more careful. Right. But many times they don't even realize they're doing it. And they move into it very quickly. We move into our own personal language of our temperament without thinking, just like I'm not thinking of every word I'm telling you.
And maybe there's more of an opportunity to be triggered in closer relationships.
Yeah, I actually wanted to ask you about triggers in a relationship. Well, let's maybe talk about a parent and child, or it could be perhaps a husband and wife, that you have a character trait that's more dominant, and it's actually not bad. But for some reason, whether because of a trauma from the past or because they're not like that, they're triggered by certain parts of your personality. Do you think that should be suppressed, or, you know, to try and tone down your personality in that way because you are in a relationship with people that you love and they're triggered by it?
I think that it's very important to have a discussion, because what exactly are they triggered by? Do you really know? Just because they say this is a trigger doesn't mean you truly understand what they're saying. And then why is it a trigger? Okay, so if the parent is doing something that they really should think about more, maybe it's an immature behavior, right? Then wait a minute, does need to be corrected. If this is the way you are, to expect someone to talk differently because this is the way they talk. Here's an example. There are people that fall into two categories. All people fall into two categories. You're either directive or you're informative. If you are directive, you tell it like it is. If you're informative, you inform. Okay. Directive people want to hear it the way it is from others also. And sometimes they struggle with informative people because they don't understand what they're saying, because they're informing. Now, here's an example, okay? The wife says to the husband, I'm going to the supermarket. I'll be back in an hour. And he says, my favorite drink is Coke. She gets in the car. She's driving to the store. It's a true story. She gets in the car and drives to the store. And what did he just say? My favorite drink is Coke. Where did that come from? What was he saying? It sounds silly. Can't figure it out. Goes to store, goes shopping, gets everything. Comes home, he helps her unpack. And he goes, no Coke? She said, you wanted Coke? Why didn't you tell me? He said, I think I did. I told you my favorite drink is Coke. She says, I couldn't figure out why you said it to me. And he's like, well, why would I say it to you if I didn't want you to buy it? You know what? Do me a favor. Next time, tell me exactly. Berachel b'chaktan. Tell me exactly. Please buy me some Coke. Can you please get some Coke? Okay. And the one that's informative just doesn't like. Why does it have? It's so direct. It grates on you. Okay. Another story. Husband is traveling, is in New York, and they're living out of town. And she says to him, she calls, I arrive and everything. And she says, you know, you have to pick up this, you have to pick up that, you have to do this. And he says, I don't have to do anything. Okay. And she's, whoa. They're living in a shtetl. They need stuff. He's in New York. And he says, I don't have to do anything. And she stops. You know, I mean, what's she going to do now? And then he says, but you know, when I'm Kingston Avenue, it's not a problem. I can stop by in the store. So
that's great. Okay. That's really great.
Now, when she says, you have to get this, you have to get this, she's not telling him what to do. Because the minute he said, I don't have to do anything, she stopped. okay, he doesn't want to do it. I can't force him. What you were saying is, this is what needs to be done. You're in New York. This is what we need. Okay. But what was he, having a hard time with? The way she was talking.
He didn't like her style of talking.
What do you mean I have to? What is this? I have to. But that's not what she meant. The problem now is, if she's very directive, and now she has to get into informative mode, it's very hard for her. Because it isn't the language that she speaks. See, you're making an assumption that I am forcing you into a situation. But I'm not doing that. I have no intent of doing that. This is the way I talk. And you don't believe me. You think I'm pushing you around. But I talk this way. And if I have to now figure out how to be informative, even though everyone can be both, it takes a lot of work. And the chances are you're going to do a worse job. Because you're not going to get it right.
So the other person needs to learn how to understand that this is the person's style of talking. And
now here's the deal with informative people. They're informative. You don't fully understand sometimes what they want from you. Or even if you do, they say it in such a way, like my favorite drink is Coke, where they say it in such a way that it give, you know, maybe I should do it. Maybe I don't want to do it. Maybe I can do it. It's not said so directly that I have to do it, right? But they absolutely expect you to do it. And when you don't, they're not happy. They may be nice about it, but they're not happy. So look at the difference. The person that's directive may not be expecting you to do it, but you're offended by the way they say it. And the person who is informative expects you to do it.
Right. But you're not. But they're not doing it because you haven't been.
But now you also have a relationship problem here, because I told you and I was so nice and I don't impose and you don't hear me. You don't.
So neither of them have a problem. It's just not understanding each other. That's the problem.
So temperament theory, it's like, whoa. And many times I'll say that you're not hearing what they're saying. They're not imposing on you at all. This is the way they talk. You want them to talk like you? I had a parent call me about a teenage child, and they were so frustrated and angry at their child and couldn't even have a positive relationship because the child is so chutzpahdik. Okay. And they go on and on about the child's chutzpah. And I say, wait, hold on. What is the chutzpah? And they tell me that they don't respond to me. They answer back. I said, give me an example. Tell me what they do. I'll ask him. If he could, you know, this is the wording. I'll ask him, you want to take out the garbage? And he says, no. I said, I didn't hear any chutzpah. She goes, what do you mean? He said, no. You asked him if he wants to take out the garbage. No, he doesn't want to do it. Why don't you just tell him to take out the garbage? And then we will see if there's chutzpah. You see the difference? And she had to learn to talk to this child differently. And when she asked him to do it, he did it. On the other hand, she also had to learn to see him as the person he is. Okay. He's not going to be who she wants him to be. Ever. He is a whole different person. She had such a hard time wrapping her head around it and needed to know how to let go, how to allow him his space, how to allow him to do the things he wants to do. Because anyway, he's going to do it. So what's the difference? And still have a good relationship with him. And the whole relationship, it turned around to the point where the child, after a few years, apologized. But if you think I'm chutzpahdik, I have nowhere to go with this relationship because now you have just labeled me. You don't understand me. You don't get me. I don't even know what I'm saying to you because I'm walking on eggshells. Because whatever I say, maybe it's chutzpah, maybe it's not. I don't know what you want from me. And I am me. I have my own makeup. You see that? And then, and many times parents push back. I can't see that. My child is really that way. You have to accept the fact people are wired differently.
It's so confusing to be able to differentiate between what do I need to change in order to improve my relationship with others? And how do I
stay steadfast in what I do, knowing that I'm,
you're right,
being the best parent, best spouse, best friend that I can be, and improve my relationships. It's a very, to me at least, it's a fine line. It's hard to be able to take the two apart.
A couple of years ago, I got a call from a mother. She's really, really struggling with her child. Child's about 5 or 6. And they're having a very hard time. They explode. They're having tantrums or they're angry. I should say they're angry. A 7-year-old child, let's say. Okay, a 5-year-old, 7, whatever. And she says, I'm so careful with the child. I'm so careful not to say any bad word. I'm so careful. And I'll tell him, I'll give you 5 more minutes. I have all this, and she's being very patient and very understanding and using the right words. And then nothing helps. So I said to her, you think you're doing the right thing. The problem is that the child is getting mixed messages. The child feels your attention. They know you're having a hard time. They know you don't like this behavior. But you're being so nice on the outside, and they don't know what's going on here. They see you say one thing, but they feel something different. Be honest. Stop having so much patience and tell them this is not behavior that is acceptable. I understand you're upset, and I'm saying something's bothering you. Either we discuss it or we work out a way to make it work. Are you hungry? Are you tired? Are you upset something happened in school? But let's get to it. But the behavior is not acceptable. This is not the way you respond. And I'm not going to put up with it. You have to make that clear. I am not going to put up with it. But I don't know if you have to use those words. Now the child knows exactly where they stand. They can feel their mother's tension, but she's so nice. She's so patient. You see what happens? It's a mixed message. And they have no idea what you're talking about. And they are so confused because they cannot even tell you what their dilemma is. They can't tell you what's bothering me. I can't say, Ma, you're not being honest, because I don't even know how to talk like that when I'm 5 or 7. Right. I don't know that it's my mother's emotions that I'm feeling. I just know something's wrong here. My mother's not being honest. Okay. So a lot of times that kind of reaction is not the right way. It's not the helpful way. I don't think we should just be yelling at our kids or anything like that, but we need to be honest. You need to be honest, and we need to look at the behavior and say, children are children. They will have negative behavior. Our job is to show them how to live healthy, how to use this, because they won't get away with it when they're 15. No friend is going to put up with what a mother puts up with. So teach. You see that? On the other hand, we're going in different directions here. On the other hand, this concept today of bimavater, the people.
Can you translate mavater?
Bimavater. Bimavater means give up or give in. So you have a toy, you're playing with a toy, your friend, your sister, whatever, comes over, your brother, and they want your toy. And they're throwing a tantrum because they want your stuff. And you don't want to give it. You want to play. And then you're told bimavater, give it up, give in. Be the nice, who's going to be the nice person? Okay. You have to be very careful with that. Because as we get into more of this, you'll see how dangerous that can be, especially for girls. You have to teach a child to share. Okay. Be nice. Okay. If you're competitive in a game, if you always need to win, you're going to lose friends. So if you're wired, people are wired to win. They are wired that way from birth. They don't understand. So how often do you play a game and somebody has to win? The same child. They're wired to win. What do you want from them? But they need to understand win-win. If you win every game, you lose friends. And in life, losing friends is a greater loss than losing a game once in a while. Now you're talking their language. A little bit. Here's another deal. If a person is expressive, there's expressive and attentive, right? People are talkers. People are listeners. A person's expressive is very fast from here to here, from head to mouth is very fast. An expressive person's going through an emotional turmoil will have to express it. Okay, they have to get it out. And a person that's attentive, it takes a while for them to get it out. Okay, so go to a therapist and you're told, oh, the person is, let's say the husband is very upset about something. Okay. And the wife is, and he is like shooting, I mean, he is so upset, he's shooting. And the wife says, you know, I see you're very upset. I'm going to give you 10 minutes so that you calm down and then we'll discuss it. It only makes it worse. If you're that type of a person who takes you 10 minutes to think things over, right, then you say, okay, I'll give you 10 minutes. But the person who has to get it out and has to just get it, and he's saying, well, you know, that's a lot for another person to take. Shooting like that and just saying things, that's a lot. Well, guess what? Holding it in is also a lot for a person to take. You just don't, it looks like it's nicer. It looks like it's more menschlich, but that's not necessarily true. Okay. The menschlich kind of a person and how nice they are and the refinement, that's a personal thing. You learn about, okay. But sometimes we're accused, and the children are accused, spouses are, we're accused of something that we're not really guilty of. It's just a style that we need to learn someone else has. Okay. So the person who has to shoot, they have to let it out. And you can say, that's so inappropriate. Would you say that to someone who has to throw up? Hold it in. Hold it in. Just hold it in until we get to the bathroom. Hold it. How do you tell somebody to hold it in if they have to let it out? So I call it emotional throw up. And I say to people, get out of the way. If somebody has to let it out, and a child also, let them. Why would you say to someone, hold in the throw up? Let them get it out. But don't take it personally. Because if you take it personally, they're throwing up all on top of you. You're standing right under their mouth and you're letting them throw up all over you. And now you have complaints. You can get out of the way. They have a harder time because they're going through it. They can't think straight. So get out of the way. Don't let them throw it. How do you do that emotionally? Don't take it personally. They're going through a hard time, even if you're to blame. But right now, it's not about you. It's about them. They're going through a hard time. And sometimes you have to turn around and say, I'm sorry that this happened. You're right. I should have been more careful. I should have been more mindful. And sometimes you have to say, you're wrong. This is not, your reaction is wrong. There was an accident on the road, and I couldn't get in touch with you. I tried once, I tried twice, it didn't go through. There was nothing I could do to get here faster. I understand you're upset, okay? But this was something that happened and it was out of my hands. So you're wrong to have. The minute you do that to the person who's reacting, they have to start thinking. And once you go into your rational head, you will automatically start controlling your emotion. Because mayach shalit al halev is a fact. The head controls the emotion. Meaning you have to go into your rational thinking. You know, when you're very riled up, you're also thinking, but you're not into your rational thinking. If you're in your memory thinking, that's not the same as in your rational thinking. But the minute you can say to somebody, wait a minute, you're not right. Okay. Or that's not the way it happened. They have to start listening. Or you can apologize and say, I didn't mean to do this to you. You still have to, they have to listen. Okay. Right. So if it's a person who needs time, then don't start blah, 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 and you start, and then you're going to rile them up much worse. They need time. Give them the time and the space, and we'll discuss it in 10 minutes. Now, why are you so upset at me? Come on, so tell me. Why are you so upset? What did I do wrong?
But can you imagine the one person needs time and the other person wants to talk? So the person that needs time has his time. The other person wants to talk. But yet you have to both understand each other.
That's a shidduch.
A good shidduch or a shidduch gone bad?
Is that a shidduch or a...
This one has to have air conditioning and this one has to have it warm. That can't stand the air conditioning. And they're both married to each other. Who made that shidduch? And that's the idea also. We talk about a wife being an Ezer Kenegda, crucial in a relationship to have an Ezer Kenegda. Because an Ezer means a person that's a helpmate, right? So a helpmate is the support that you get from the other, one who has your back, one who is supporting you in this relationship. And the Kenegda is when you have to push back and be different and say, no, this is not acceptable. One must have both in the relationship. And with children also, it should be like that, okay? You have to, with parents, you have to be careful. Because it's kibbutz A. But an Ezer Kenegda, especially in relationship, It has, that's the way Hashem made it. It cannot be totally azer, help, help, even when they're not doing what's best for them, or kenegdai, against them, you don't value who they are. You don't see their benefit because you're constantly pushing back. No, it doesn't work either way. It doesn't, it, you need that balance.
What if you have some, what if you have a relationship where one person is rigid and one person is more flexible?
That's fabulous.
So then is it okay if the flexible person is just super flexible and the rigid person stays pretty rigid because it works for them? Or is that not really easy or connect? Right. Okay. So it's whatever works for the couple. Yeah.
Yes. If it works for them, then it works. If it doesn't work for them, now they've got to work.
Initially going into the relationship, like in the dating process, should someone look out for somebody that's different to them, like opposites attract, or should somebody look out for somebody that's similar to them? Like what would work best, bringing out the best in someone because they're different to you or because they're similar to you?
I think you need both. There needs to be commonality. There must be some kind of commonality. We talk about unconditional love. And then you look and you say, how could it be unconditional? You have to have something in common. That's not what unconditional love means. Okay. Commonality is necessary, in my opinion, in relationship. People do not speak the same. They have nothing in common. They don't speak the same language, actually. They don't speak the same language from background. They don't speak. I mean, you must have some kind of commonality. The chances are two peas in a pod is very, very, it's almost non-existent. Some people are more different. Some people are less different. But that nothing should arise within the relationship that they needs to be a back and forth or a compromise. And they're married for 70 years and nothing came up, no compromise in 70, it's not going to. So are some relationships more peaceful than others? Yes. But some people may like that excitement in the relationship and they don't want it so peaceful. They'd be bored in a peaceful relationship. And some people want that peaceful relationship. So I don't think anybody can make a blanket statement. This is better than that. That's better. It's a bashert thing. It's bashert. It's meant to be. Can it work? We can make every relationship work. You can make it work. Is it possible that some people don't want to make it work or it's abusive and you can't? When I say it is a possible. Does it mean it always works out that way? That's a different story.
But on the onset, what should someone look for, do you think?
When people go out, first of all, people can say, you know, this is what I want. Okay, I want this. And it has to be realistic and simple and not just crazy. I once had this young man say to me, he was looking for a very accomplished, gorgeous, remarkable girl. And I very honestly, I said, did you look in the mirror?
I know. Sometimes I want to say it. I'm a matchmaker. Sometimes I want to say that.
You know what?
Did you say that to him?
Because I didn't say it the first time. It was like, what are you coming to me for? I said, I can't. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. After a while, it was like enough already. I said, what are you looking for that for? Are you sophisticated enough, accomplished enough to marry such a girl? And if you're not, you know what you're asking for? It's not going to be a pleasant life. Marry a simpler person and you'll have a much more pleasant life. I mean, the man has to match up to the you. Women have expectations. It's very interesting, this whole idea of equality. We want to be treated equally, right? I've been through the whole thing, being out on shlichus and all that. We want to be treated equally as women. And then I realized something. But you want your husband to be smarter than you, earn more money than you, taller than you, older than you. Women want more of their spouse than exactly equal. They don't have as much respect. So it's not fair. Men are not looking for that. If they want it, good. But they're not necessarily looking for somebody that's more than them. Actually, they don't want it. It's very intimidating to have somebody.
Scared of that.
Right. Very intimidating to them. All right? And we say equality, equality, equality. And then what? You're just like me? Not more and better? It's not. With true equality, the concept was treat me equally. And we mixed it up by saying I need to be like a man. but I need the mitzvahs of the man. I need to, because it's confusion. That's what happens with dysfunction. You have tremendous amount of confusion. This looks better. This looks equal. This looks, but it's not necessarily so. So in the relationship, the language that each one speaks is very, very important. Aside from being directive and formative, also you grow up in a certain home and your home has its own language. And you can say something which would just be funny or nothing. Nobody would be offended in your own home. But when you say it in your husband's home or to your husband, it means a totally different thing to him. And now you have to learn each other's language. And you never meant that. So, yeah, temperance theory, each one has their own language. And then you have your environment language. And so when you talk about similarities or differences, there needs to be a basis of similarity. There needs to be some kind of commonality, because then what do you fall back on? Okay. On the other hand, many times if the other one appreciates the difference, like I said, the guardian and the artisan marriage, the artisan it likes being married to the guardian, even though at certain times they get frustrated, but overall they like it because the guardian keeps them grounded. Okay. Because the artisan can be impulsive. So it keeps them grounded, okay? On the other hand, the guardian likes being married to the artisan because it brings fun in their life. They're serious. And now it brings in the fun and the lighter element. So it's nice.
It can be if you appreciate, when you start to appreciate that, I guess.
Yes.
It cannot be if you're just looking at the differences.
That is true.
They don't relate.
So that is true. But in relationship, if we do not see the gift of the other, then what are we in a relationship for my own benefit? So am I abusing them now? Even if it's a small thing? Oh, I got into this only for me. So why did I get into a relationship with another human being when they are a person? It's not a pet. It's not a plant. It's not a rock. Okay, this is a human being. And I got into a relationship so they should do as my bidding? Is that slavery? What is this? Is this marriage or what? You know, so if you're getting into a relationship and it's only for me, what am I getting out of it? It's not about relationship. It's about self-gratification. That's not fair. So yes, should I realize that when I say things in a certain way, I'm not being clear? My husband is directive and I'm informative, and maybe I need to really I move in that direction. If I am so I can learn better how to do it. If I am direct and it's too much, okay. So do I need to accommodate that? If you could tell on the way I talk, I'm very direct. Okay. And I have told my children, my married children, I've made it very clear, my adult children, that when I tell you something, you don't have to do it. Just because I say this is what you should be doing does not mean you have to do it. This is not a command. If I am telling you, you have to do something, and because you have to, I'll say to you, this is for an inyan of kibud av aim. This you need to listen to. Okay.
Can I use that as an example? Because your directive, let's say with your older married children.
I just want to make something very clear, though.
Okay.
I will never give them a directive. My adult will do something, lean that direction, saying, okay, that they must do for me. The directive will always be for them. You have to go to sleep now. And it's an inyan of kibud av aim. You're too tired. And I am telling you, for kibud av aim, you have to listen to me and go to sleep right now. Because they need to hear. Sometimes they're so overworked, you just got to pick them up and put them into their bed. So I'm not saying that that's what I, but usually they'll fall under the category of they just need someone to tell them that, stop, you must take care of yourself. But I would never, even though I'm that directive, it will never happen. You must carry the stuff in from the car, and that's kibud av aim. No, you won't, we never hear it from me. Okay. So I can sound very directive, but it doesn't mean that a person who can be very direct doesn't mean that they're necessarily harsh, or at least what they're saying now isn't harsh. They're just, that's the style of talk. Go ahead. Now, what do you want to say?
No, I want to say you brought up older children, like your married children or older children. Let's say there was something, if you're a stronger personality, there was something they were triggered by. It's a different relationship than a husband and wife, a mother and child, like.
Or maybe stronger children too.
So, yeah. Or you could have stronger children too, that they're like, oh, I'm triggered by this, but you'd like kind of the question I was asking in the beginning, it's, wouldn't it be different in a parent-child relationship? Because as a parent, if you feel your child is triggered, I better stop that completely. Although it's not a bad thing. They're just triggered by it.
It's interesting. I would be more concerned, triggered between spouses than between parent and child.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't have to be concerned about the triggers. You just have to be concerned that you're doing it right or trying your best. You're not going to always get it right, but trying your best. And if the child is triggered, why? Now, yeah, it could be that when they were younger, whatever, you didn't have the same patience as you have now. It could be when you were younger, you were less mature and your mothering skill weren't as good. All those things could be. So talk about it. Talk about it. They're going to be an adult one day, or they are a parent one day. They're going to go through the same mistakes. It may not be the exact same thing you did, but it's going to follow the same pattern. Who doesn't? But it allows you to be who you are. It's allowing yourself to be who you are with your mistakes also teaches them that they can do the same for themselves. And that is very important. In Chassidus and Tanya, we learn that the entire role of a lifetime here on earth is what we accomplish with our challenges. It's the work that we do, not the things that were easy. In life, think about growing up, parents, school. The children that are easier get much more positive feedback. But Tanya tells us something totally different. The harder it took you, the more work it takes from you, that is the greater accomplishment. Unfortunately, we do not give that feedback and we do not get that feedback. If it comes easy, it doesn't have the same beauty as the beauty of life of struggle. Now, we don't want to struggle, so we ask for blessings. But nevertheless, you see the balance here. I don't think avoiding triggers should be a focus for any parent. I think parenting a child at their level and accepting them for who they are and yet teaching them to be the best they can be is the goal. And will you trigger? Absolutely. Because if you don't trigger, then you're not demanding of them. Okay. Again, there is a mitzvah of kibud av va'em. A child, that is the mitzvah, kibud av va'em, non-conditionally. You have to respect your parents. You don't have to agree with them. You don't have to do what they tell you if it hurts you or it doesn't work for you. But you have to be respectful, even if there are triggers. I would advise, first of all, find out why there are triggers. What does this trigger?
Let's just say a child is sensitive and when a parent speaks in a very directive way, it bothers a child. So the child will say, "Mommy, when you tell it to me like that, like it's very uncomfortable for me." So is my job as a parent to be more soothing?
How would you like me to say it?
So let's say I say, "How would you like me to say it?" And they say, "Just say it in a much more calm way."
Tell me exactly how. Tell me how I'm saying it now, and tell me how you would like me to say it. Because, you see, I talk the way I talk. You talk the way you talk, right? We all talk our own way. So now tell me but now you're asking me to talk differently than I talk. But this is the way I talk, right? So tell me what would make it work for you? And I will try my best. I cannot promise you. Because again, that's like me asking you to do this. I would then absolutely give an example for them to do things the way I talk. So I want you to be very directive now, and they'll push back, right? No, but that's not fair. This is the way I talk this. And I'm not talking about cruelty. We're not talking about it. We're talking about style. Right.
Yeah, I'm talking about style, personality. Yeah.
Yes. That's all we're talking about. So now to teach them that different people talk differently it's actually a positive. Now, you're saying to me, I should talk like this, and I will try my best. I really will. But I don't know if I can always do that. Sometimes I'll be tired. Sometimes things will happen, and then I'll get back to my regular self. Okay? So let's practice. You talk like me, and I talk like you. And then they'll see how hard it is. Okay? Then they'll see how hard it is. And sometimes the harder you try, the worse it comes out.
What if a child comes home and says that there's someone at school who's very cold? And so I'll say it could be that it's that person's style of communication. But for a child, it's very hard.
What does that mean? How do you know that the child is cold? How do you know? What does that mean a child is cold?
She doesn't respond to me when I talk to her, or she smiles at other girls and won't smile at me.
Oh,
things like that.
You're going into clicks, and you're going into negative behavior.
But possibly, yeah. But
it's not negative behavior.
That child's, according to that child, it is negative behavior. The child was experiencing this cold.
So the question is the child really cold or shy? Is the child shy? Is the child uncomfortable? I don't know what the situation. Now, let's say worst case scenario, they're being cold. So you have to teach a child how to handle when someone's cold to you. Okay, don't be a victim. Don't become vulnerable. You have to train a child. It may not be the easiest thing, but the reality is that if you train them, they become much stronger, and they can see it in a different light. We cannot clean up every situation, but we can make ourselves a healthier person. Okay. So yes, I would have the discussion. I would also have the discussion if there's something the child's doing to add to it. Okay. There can be very hurtful situations. Children go through very, very hurtful situations, but having someone that has their back takes care of 70% of the problem at least. So, or as a parent that you can go back to, you know what I mean? Yeah.
Did you want to add something to that?
No, go ahead.
It seems like, I mean, any question we ask you, you have a lot of wisdom. So we want to know.
This is God's credit, not the, you know what I mean? And you know what? You may have heard this, but, you know, a young man went to a wise man and asked him how he became wise. Mm-hmm. And he says, from experience. So he said, well, how did you get the experience? From making good choices in life. And he said, so how did you know to make the good choices from bad choices in life?
Yeah.
You get to my age, you'll be wise. If you don't think, I'm sure you're wise today, but it comes with experience and a lot of mistakes along the way.
So, let me just ask you though, I was going to ask you something else, but I want to ask you this about mistakes. Have you forgiven yourself your mistakes? Like, how do you forgive yourself?
I think it's very important to forgive yourself for your mistakes. Forgiveness is very important in Judaism, right? You ask forgiveness three times, and the third time, you don't have to go back again. Okay, if you look at what you've done and you truly sorry about it, you regret it. And you make changes in your life. That's great. That's what's expected. That's what is expected of us, of the masses, or whoever, you know what I mean? The people who are not great tzaddikim. To regret, to have remorse, and then to change it. I won't do this. You really make every effort not to do it again. And if it takes a few times before you really get it through, you get it through. But having and forgiving, one has to forgive oneself. I think we're harder on ourselves than Hashem is on us. I really think so. Unless we are not hard on ourselves at all, and that's not good. But if there is true growth and maturity, and seeing that we made a mistake, and yes, our kids were the recipients of those mistakes, or our spouses, or whoever it may be, even our parents, whoever may be our siblings, but you come to a point that that you are truly sorry, then God has forgiven you. So you can't forgive yourself. It's hard. It's very, very hard to forgive oneself many times, but you have to. And the reason you have to, this is at least the way I see it, because then the thing that you did that causes you to have such remorse is viewed very negatively if you do not forgive yourself. You can't come to terms with it. So let's take a child that's doing something, or it's a, I don't know, give me an example. If you can give me an example. If you don't.
Let's say you raised your kids differently when they were younger, and you've learned along the way as you get older that you would have, let's say, done certain things differently in the way.
And you are doing them differently?
Yeah.
Forgive yourself, because you will always notice what you did wrong. And the child in your eyes has this flaw. Maybe you're the one that caused the stitches, let's say. Let's say you slapped it, whatever, you did something, and they have a bruise from it for the rest of their life. Let's just say. And if you notice the bruise every single time, then you're not really noticing your child fully. But if you notice your child and you have forgiven yourself, the bruise gets smaller and smaller, even in them. You understand what I'm saying? You have to let it go and forgive yourself and see them for the gift that they are. Because if you don't, then you'll always notice. You'll always notice the flaw. And it's not fair. It's not fair to them. So at least have kindness for them. It's not fair. It's not fair to yourself. You were a kid. And it's of no benefit. Okay. If you haven't noticed and you have made no change, that's a different story. Okay. But that is the goal of a Beinoni. That's our mission here. That I'm a better today. I am better. I'm a better person today than I was yesterday. If you can look back 10 years and go, I can't even recognize myself. Well, thank God for that.
Okay. Thank you for sharing that. And can you share with us in what ways your work has helped you in your personal life and in the lives of other people?
It has been a tremendous asset. It's helped me, and I am very grateful to the Eibushter, to God, for the gift that he has given me. It's a remarkable gift. Being able to see people for who they are takes away the struggle of Avos Yisrael, of love of fellow Jew. When you can see everyone's gift, and even when they're not using it right, and when they're really not using it right, you have rachmanis. You see the talent, and yet they're not using it, you know? And usually it's when people, it happens, that's when there's a lot of negative behavior. But in everyone, it's amazing. Oh, this is the way they are, sure. I mean, I'm, why are you surprised? Okay. I can see it. I can understand it. I can. And even if it's not used 100%, well, it doesn't matter. We're human. So when it comes to actually helping people, and I explain who they are, they're like blown away. They can't believe how well they're understood when they haven't really told me deep thoughts and deep, just knowing their temperament. It's funny in relationship. It's funny because I can tell them, oh, you like touch a lot, but your spouse likes space. Oh boy, you guys have a lot of fun with this. I hope you don't take it personally. And they crack up because they know that's exactly what's going on. Okay. They feel rejected because they want to hold their partner, and the partner is like, give me some space. So what happens now? There's rejection. And the other one's walking on eggshells, and they don't know what each one did. And yet it's just a different need. Because for this one, touch is at the top of the list, and this one, it's at the bottom of the list, right? And now it's not personal. And because I know that is their need, they haven't even told me that, okay, that they have this situation. I know because of temperaments. And sometimes I'll say, oh, you've got two different temperaments, but touch is important to both of you. That's fabulous. And like, how do you know that? Okay. And it helps so, but it also minimizes the stress of the problem because they realize it's not what I think it is. It's not personal. It's wiring. You see that? So that has been very, very helpful that I don't have to, I'm not judging people when I'm working with them.
But you can know someone's personality and analyze it and still judge them. How do you get, I just want to know one of your tools of how to get to that place.
I don't judge the person. I can judge the behavior.
Huh.
I can say, you know, it's silly. You want to do this. It's your choice. But if you want to get out of this situation, this isn't going to work if you keep doing it like this. I can guide you. I can help you. But sometimes people like being in what they are, even if they're suffering, because that's what's familiar. And I can say that to them straight out, and it's your choice. But you can't really judge people because everybody comes from difficult places. Everyone. Even if it's the best home, it's the best this, it's the best that, they're not coming to me if it's everything's the best. They're not asking my guidance. Okay. If everything works, why are they coming to me, right? If once they're coming to anybody for advice, when it's relationship, then something isn't working, right? And a lot of times it's baggage that came from before. And a lot of, you can't judge. It doesn't. And what if I was them? Would I do differently? With all the mistakes and all the narishkeit and all the silliness and all the foolishness, what if I was exactly them? Would I do different? The chances are no. So, okay. I told my children, one should never be a victim in life. And one should never be a perpetrator. But if you have no choice, be grateful you're the victim. And they go, really? I said, would you rather be the perpetrator?
Yeah.
Okay. Right? So you guys, so judgment, it, you know what I mean? But is the behavior wrong? Is it unacceptable? Yeah, that could very well be. It could be unacceptable behavior and you're not going to put up with it.
I just got one little question from the middle of the conversation. When you said, that's a shidduch, how is the person who's the opposite, who needs the time, who's the one that's meant to make the change? Like, what if, you know what I'm saying? Who's the one that's meant to be like, okay, I'm going to give you your time. And who's the one that's going to say, okay, I'm going to let her talk or let him talk? Do you know what I'm saying?
It depends on the need.
No, but what if both, because you're saying both people should be allowed to be who they are, which if they're allowed to be who they are, how is anything going to be solved if one person's quiet and one person's talking?
What do you mean? If one person's
talking, you said both.
Listening, if the person, that's perfect. Because if the person, if they're both talking at the same time, nobody's listening. If they're both not talking at the same time.
No, but the person that needs their time doesn't want to hear talking.
oh, the person who doesn't. So then you have to compromise. Each one has to compromise. You have to, why do I need my own time right now? Why? Is it something that I must have because I can't function? Or
that person needs space.
That's true, but you don't need space all the time.
Yeah, in that moment.
If you need it in that moment, then you need it. But maybe
the other person needs to talk.
Well, maybe. So you have to gauge what's more important.
You have to gauge who's more important or what's more important.
You have to gauge. Look, each one, this is a relationship. We're focused on each other. This is a relationship. Okay. So if my spouse needs to talk now and I would like my space right now, I can say to myself, you know what? He really needs this. I will take my space in 20 minutes. This is what he needs right now. I don't need my space so much right now that I can't hear him. But what happens if you can't? I mean, God forbid, you know, you look at when tragedy happens to people, you think that the spouses would turn and support each other. But many times it causes tremendous negative effect on the relationship because they are both in so much pain that they cannot turn to each other. So that's what you're saying. They're both making noise or they both need their space. So that's in trauma. That's in very difficult situations. And maybe you need outside intervention and help. But thank God, most of the time, hopefully we don't live like that. So, I mean, I'm so exhausted because I just had a baby and I have to get my sleep or I have to take care of the baby. I can't listen right now. I have to. Okay, but maybe I can. Maybe I can push off my need for my time and my space a half hour.
Right. So you're saying one person should push off their need. One person needs to do it.
And the next time the other one does it.
Right. So you're saying it should be both ways. Sometimes one person. So how does that start? I guess if one of the people in the relationship see that the other one has worked on themselves to accommodate, then maybe the next time they will.
The more supportive you are in mature situations and most situations, the more mature you are towards the other, they will reciprocate. Or you can say, you know, I need this. You're talking about, you know, mature people. The problem happens if after 18 years of bottling things up, we're not understanding each other, you come to such frustration that one says, I've always given them the time. I've always listened. And the other one says, no, I've been the one that has always given you the time because they bottled it up. They didn't really have good communication. Okay. So now you also need some intervention to say, look, are you really seeing this correctly? Right. And explain it just like triggers, just like a child, you know, the other child is cold to me. You have to go through it and say, is this correct? Is this correct? And that's why when the Rebbe talks about the concept of a mashpia, you know, you think of going for therapy and this, and then sometimes people look at it as negative today, not so much. But let's say 60% of the population are within the range of norm. You can have very healthy 20, very unhealthy 20. But within the norm is the 60. You need guidance. Situations come up. Go for guidance. Go for a mashpia. Go for someone that you can trust. A rabbi. There was always, you went to the rabbi, you went to the rabbitson, you went to the somebody, you go, your mother, your father, you go for guidance.
Okay. Important.
That's very important. Yeah.
Is there a practical tool or tip or strategy or intervention, something that you use in your practice with people that you see that you can recommend?
Is a tip on how you can be yourself and also accommodate, and also you're able to shine in who you are and also be able to give and hear the other person that you're with in the relationship.
So the first thing, I think one thing is very important, is to listen and to not make up your own story while somebody is talking to you. We very quickly go into our own perception of things and we start assuming that this is what they meant. Okay. Very important to listen, because they're telling you something, and what they're telling you is what it is. It makes sense to you, doesn't make sense. You have that. The most important, I think it's very important to listen. Then you can go into understanding, analysis. Okay. So that's one thing. The other thing is, don't move in to taking things personally unless you know for sure that this was meant to hurt you. If somebody says something to me and then I assume something, is that true? Is that true? Right? We are told to be don l'chafschus. To be don l'chafschus doesn't mean give them the benefit of the doubt. That's if there is a doubt, you must give them the benefit. That's according to halacha. What do you mean? You're assuming that they did it wrong when they didn't? So if there is a doubt, you must give them the benefit. That's not in Judaism that they give them the benefit of the doubt. Of course. Don l'chafschos means you judge them to merit. There must be something positive here. Maybe they're going through a hard time. Maybe this, maybe that. But you come up with a positive here. Don't judge them for negative. Don't assume that they're angry at you or something happened, whatever. Assume a positive. I'll give you an example. A woman comes over to me and she says to you, I owe you an apology. I said, not that I know of. She goes, I really do. I owe you an apology. I said, please don't tell me, because I don't know what you owe an apology for. So why tell me? Okay. I said, here's the deal. when somebody walks by me, I don't know why this came out of my mouth, but when somebody walks by me and ignores me, I don't think that they have something. I don't assume that they have something against me. I automatically think they must be going through a hard time, or something happened today, or they're distracted because company's coming in from out of town, whatever it may be. So there's nothing, I don't know what happened or what you did, but there's nothing to apologize for because okay. So she says, you know, that's exactly what happened. I walked by you and I was going through a very hard time and I didn't say hello and I'm the Revison. So, you know, okay. And she held on to that for a few years before she came to apologize, or a few months or whatever it may be. But I will tell you an interesting story. I was standing by the Rebbe once in the, as you go into that first room, you know, the hallway or whatever, the foyer, when the Rebbe would go to Mincha, we had come in from out of town and I brought the kids and I wanted them to see the Rebbe. And so we were standing on line. The kids were in the front row. As the Rebbe would walk out, the kids would be in the front and they'd get their coin and they put in the pushka. And I'm standing either one or two rows behind. There are more people in. And as we're waiting for the Rebbe, this woman turns around. I have no idea who she is, but there was something wrong with her face. I don't even remember what, but there was something really wrong with her face. And I thought, oh my gosh, to have a face like that. And the door opens and the Rebbe comes out. So now you're totally distracted. You know, you're not thinking of that anyway. And there was giving coins and okay. And there it goes in from Mincha. And we all turned to leave. And as I hit the steps, I thought to myself, wait a minute. I'm standing here before the Rebbe and that's what I'm thinking about? That's all I noticed was what was wrong with her face? She may have had beautiful eyes. Maybe she saved a life. Maybe she's a wonderful person. That's all I noticed. And this is the way I came to the Rebbe? It bothered me terribly. And I made a hachlata, that I made a resolution. I cannot control my first thought. But when I see people, I will look for something positive to say. Wow. I love the color of your sweater. That's a pretty ring. I will find something, okay? You have very pretty eyes. Something. It doesn't make a difference. I will look for a compliment and say it. Maybe a half a year goes by. And a woman says to me, you know, every time I see you, you always say something nice to me. And I thought to myself, little do you know that you did me a bigger kindness than I did to you, because now I know that it's part of me. Okay? So it takes work to do that.
Wow.
Good takes work. Everything else, it just happens.
But now it's become a part of you. So is that the dominant part of you, or is this just something that you work on?
Bringing it all together.
It's the same me who had to take a weakness and strengthen it and turn it around. Okay. So would I have done that if I hadn't had the weakness? Would I, you know what I mean? So it's work. It's work. And every time now, it's work. It's good. It's good. Okay, so should I not forgive myself? No, I did something with it. I did something positive. Okay?
Beautiful.
Okay, so should we, Rivka, any more questions before we wrap up?
I could go on and on, but we took up a lot of your time, yes. Precious time.
Okay, so we love to wrap up with either a quote or a parting message that resonates with you, if you can share one with us.
I love Chassidus. I love Tanya. It's such a remarkable, remarkable sefer. It's such a remarkable gift the Alter Rebbe gave us. And what you see as we learn Tanya is that by God, we matter. We matter no matter. To me, that is so remarkable. Yes, we could make our mistakes. Yes, we are a Rosh of Itayvali. Yes, you know, we have remorse and we correct ourselves, and that gives God so much pleasure. The question is, why would God create this world? Why couldn't he made it easier? Why not all of us be Beinonim? Why not most of us be Beinoni? At least if not Tzaddikim Beinoni. Why? But when do you know that the relationship matters? When do you know that the love is unconditional? Not when you're doing what I want you to do, because I'm getting nachas out of it. How do you know it's not self-gratification? But when you see in somebody, your child, your spouse, your parent, okay, they're not doing, your sibling, what you really wanted them to do, and you love them anyway because they matter. They matter no matter. When do you find out how much someone matters to you? Is when they're not doing what you want. And this is such a great gift from the Eirishter. We matter no matter. Can we do that for others? Growing up by the Rebbe, his face would shine when he saw us as children. And we just wanted to be the person that the Rebbe saw in us. But the Rebbe saw us, didn't see our flaws. Wouldn't that be remarkable if we could do that? If we could feel that's the way the Eibushter looks at us? Yes, you have to work. Yes, you have to do what you have to do. Yes, there is a mission. That's the gift. That it doesn't matter how I become and what I do, but he trusts I'll get there with my mistakes. He trusts me with all my mistakes. I'll tell you a cute story and then I'll finish off. My father, who I have tremendous respect for, and I have a huge debt of gratitude for what he's given me in life, at one point felt that I was not disciplining one of my children correctly. And he...
Can I ask you, how many children do you have?
Nine. Nine, thank God. Yeah. They're all coming with the kids, the grandkids. Nine, her.
Wow.
Anyway, yes. Boy, so
have nachas.
Yeah. Yes, thank God. So I said to him, I said, Todd, this is for me. This is my job, I said to him. It's my job to discipline my child. He says, but I don't think you're doing this correctly. I said, yeah, but the Eibushter gave me this child. So he's trusting me. So if the Eibushter trusts me, even with my mistakes, and he smiled and he just sort of gave up. So you're going to, that's the point. That is the point. We have to work. We have to. That's love. Be the best you can be and put all that work in and learn from your mistakes. And there is room for growth until 120. That is remarkable. But you matter no matter. Forgive yourself and move towards goodness.